Welcome to Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis. You can check out my books and social media at mindymcginnis.com and visit the Writer Pants on Fire blog at writerpantsonfire.blogspot.com. Today's guest is author Sophie Perrineau, who writes high-concept fiction that is set in the past. Her works include The Sister Queens, Medici Daughter, and A Day of Fire, a novel of Pompeii. Sophie joined me to talk about querying the old-fashioned way with self-addressed stamped envelopes and the brutal truth about agented projects that don't sell. As always, I want to ask about your query journey and your agent hunt process. Tell us about how you went from an aspiring to a published author.
Well, perhaps appropriately for someone who's basically obsessed with the past, I got my agent the most old-fashioned way possible. Paper query, snail mail. I used to hate to go to the mailbox because those self-addressed stamped envelopes, usually when they come back, they're bad news. But actually, My agent, Jacques Desprobert, actually sent me the request for material by self-addressed stamped envelope. And he was actually my number one choice agent, so much so that when he actually offered representation, I withdrew full manuscripts that were with other agents, which is something that generally is not recommended. Mm-hmm. But for me, it really worked out because we've been together almost 9 years. And I think what's interesting is when people hear that, they think, oh, well, that's the fairy tale story. But I actually view it as more of an endurance tale. And there's actually a couple of aspects that I'd like to share with people who are hunting for agents right now. My first thing is, if I had one bit of advice for everyone, it would be look for fit. I mean, this is an important business partnership. And I think people get so desperate, they query everyone, and then they take the first agent who asks. Mm-hmm. And I had the opportunity to do something that I know isn't possible for everyone, but to the extent people can make it happen, I would. I met my agent in person before we decided to work together. He invited me to lunch in New York. I took the train there. We looked each other in the eye. We discussed not only the manuscript, but my vision of my path for myself as a writer, his vision of that, and his way of doing business. As a result of that, by the time we got to the end of dessert, he was ready to offer, and I was entirely confident to accept right then on the spot because the fit was just obvious to me. The other thing I would say is the second thing is follow the rules. Follow the rules, but here's the caveat, cheat if you have to, because I cheated. I'd sent out a couple of batches of queries, thank God not to my A-listers, and I kept failing to hit the 20% request rate. And then I had this published historical novelist tell me something. And she said, you know, your letter is not the problem. Your problem is your word count. Your word count is actually scary. And then she said, leave it out. And I'm like, what? And she's like, I left it out. And that's heresy. I left my word count out. My request rate shot up to nearly 40% overnight. And at that stage, I decided, oh God, this rule breaking is really working for me. So I did not put my word count on my partials either. Only time someone got to see my word count is if they requested a full. And the funniest story related to that is because my agent is so old school, when he asked for my full, he asked for it printed. Wow. So I printed this massive stack out and I mailed it to him and I got this phone call and it was him. And he said, so Sophie, remind me, did I have any idea how long this book was when I asked for it? And I had to come clean. I said, no, you didn't. But it did not stop him from reading it. He just asked for more time, and it did not stop him from repping me.
What was your word count? Do you remember?
No, it was obscene. And the good news and bad news about that is we cut a lot, and that book, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, didn't sell. That's the other thing I think people forget. Everyone starts out, and they think, oh, when I sign with my agent, it is the pinnacle of this climb. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people it's base camp. I mean, having a great agent and a great manuscript is terrific, but it does not mean selling a book immediately. And I'm sure you've heard the statistic, at least I have, that 50% of agented writers fail to sell their first manuscript. I came close to a deal and then poof, it just vaporized. It never materialized. So, you know, that was very panic inducing because you feel like you've beat these huge odds to get this agent. And now you've sold this book, you've not sold this book, and you hear stories. I personally know people who were in that situation where their agent said, well, that's it. And they had to re-query. And I was very fortunate because Jacques said to me, I believe in you. I believe in your work. So how about if you write me another book? Of course, that lit a fire under me because I'm thinking, oh, well, he's not going to wait around forever. So between the day we had this little discussion about the different ideas in my file and which one I should pursue next, because we picked that together, from that day till the day I inked my contract for my debut, only 9 months passed.
Wow.
Yeah, I'll never be able to do that again. I think that was panic-induced. There's book production, and nobody really counts on how long that takes. Yeah, so my debut actually came out about 4 years after my agent and I officially became a team.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that most people don't realize, and I think even aspiring authors don't necessarily realize, is that you get your agent, and there is a submission period where you're going out, and you may not sell your first book. You may not sell your second book. Hopefully your agent sticks with you. You sounds like you had luck in that arena. But there are definitely times when you get an agent and the agent isn't able to sell your book and you end up back querying, which I'm sure would be heartbreaking. But also not selling your first book is common. And I was actually on the very last round of submissions for my debut when I got picked up. And my agent had said to me, if this doesn't fly, we'll go into writing something else. And I was like, oh, okay. And it is like a cement block on your heart because you really felt like you'd accomplished something and you had just by getting an agent. But that is no guarantee of publication.
No, it's definitely not. And I think the truth is I don't even blame agents who decide to walk away in that situation, because I think the other thing that people forget about agents is they're basically working for free until you sell something.
That's right.
And you're not going to meet too many people in your life, perhaps outside of your parents, who are going to be willing to put that kind of time and energy into you on spec.
So you definitely started out with some speed bumps with your first book not getting sold. And you've hit some sense. You've been what we call orphaned editorially, which means that the editor who acquired your work initially left the house during the process of making the novel into a finished product. So tell us about that. What was it like to be an orphan?
Well, my orphaning actually happened with my most recent novel, which is Medici Daughter. And basically between the acquisition of that novel and its immediate post-release period, so let's just say over a period of less than 18 months, I was orphaned not once, but twice. So first, my acquiring editor made what I am sure was a very difficult decision, and that was not to return to work from maternity leave. God, the day I got that email. I mean, I'm not going to lie, my stomach just fell. And then, thank heavens, I was very fortunate in that I was claimed by another editor the same day. I was basically claimed by the assistant who had been working with me while my editor was out on leave. So my agony wasn't prolonged, but I was also fortunate in that my book was already quite far along in the production process. I had actually already done my page proofs. Mm-hmm. So my release was not delayed. I've known a lot of people who get orphaned who their release is then delayed. But then, so I thought, this is going to be fine. And then a few months after my book hit shelves, surprise, my new editor departed. And the craziest thing about this piece of the story is neither my agent nor I, we weren't informed of this officially. We found out when my agent tried to contact my editor with a sales-related question. That's really not a great way to find out. So I would say, for me, the bottom line is that having gone through the publication process for my first novel from acquisition all the way to long after release with an editor who was really a full partner in the labor of putting out that book. She was very developmentally editorial. She was very invested in the cover and the marketing. I could say with certainty that that type of consistency is better. It's a better experience. And I believe it results in a more seamless vision for the book, including more seamless support. But here's the truth. As writers, we have zero control over that. My advice would be you've got to roll with the punches, and you've always, always got to stay 200% on top of production and post-release fate for your own work. Because if you assume everybody's doing their job, as in any other field, you will find out sometimes in the worst possible way that that is not the case.
And you mentioned maternity leave. That happened to me as well with my fantasy. my acquiring editor went on maternity leave and went home and basically had her baby and found out it was her first. And so it was so much more than she expected that she discovered that there was no way she would be able to work full time and be a mom. And a lot of people don't realize, especially editors that are lower on the totem pole, they do not make much money. I have seen some breakdowns in Publishers Weekly of editors' pay, and I've been very surprised that they don't make a lot of money. And so some of them don't. Some of the higher ones make good money, but some of them, and my editor at the time was an assistant editor, and so she had acquired me very early in her career and basically went home, had a baby, was overwhelmed at that responsibility, and then basically did the math of childcare and what she makes and going back and forth and was like, it's not worth it for me to go back to work. And I completely understand that decision. So I had a cool experience with being orphaned because I was actually orphaned up. I went up the ladder of editors because basically I was then loose, you know, in the house, and the authors were just kind of being farmed out. And one of the senior editors, Ari Lewin, who is Rick Yancey's editor, she edited The Fifth Wave. She spotted my name and my project, was like, I want that, and grabbed it up. And so I've been very fortunate to have actually been adopted by someone that really wanted me and really wanted the project and has been a fantastic partner in that. But yes, that original phone call of, yeah, I'm not returning, I'm sorry, I wish you the best of luck, is scary because no one, you worry that no one is going to care about your project and care about you the way your acquiring editor did.
Well, and I will say, in her, to her credit, the younger editor who inherited me cared deeply about the project, and she loved my work. And so I was fortunate that way as well. And I can tell you, I know other authors who have been orphaned who have moved up the chain, but unlike you, it hasn't been a positive experience because I have literally known people who've been orphaned whose new editors never read their work.
Yeah.
So
that
it's
happens.
Just lightning. You get the lucky lightning, or you get the lightning that leaves you smoldering.
I've been orphaned twice. I was orphaned at Harper when my acquiring editor for Not a Drop to Drink and In a Handful of Dust left for Bloomsbury. She took a different position in a different house, and then they hired in a new editor, and they just kind of held me until they hired in. And my new editor, I say new, but he's actually worked on me with more books than anyone else. He is fantastic. I love him. We get along perfectly. So I have been very lucky. Both times I was orphaned, it ended up being a wonderful experience. I know it's not true for everyone, but I have been well treated in both houses that I'm at.
Well, I think the bottom line is publishers, more than people realize, they do view authors as part of the team, and they do. I know there's a lot of talk about the industry not valuing the content suppliers. That hasn't been my experience either. When someone leaves, you've got a situation in which other people have to pick up that slack, and people are running around like chickens with their heads chopped off. And so I'm not even sure when it doesn't go well that that's in fact, I would say it's not intentional on anyone's part. But I was a lawyer before I was a writer. I can remember you're on a case, you've got a team, and someone leaves the firm. I mean, it is very stress-inducing for the people on the ground, and I'm sure the same is true in book production.
Up next, the necessary research required for writing historical fiction while keeping story as the focus, the difference between an anthology versus a continuity novel, and the unique pressures of working on a project that involved 6 different authors.
You write novels set in the past. How do you dive into the world of your characters, and what do you think novels set in the past can offer to modern readers?
Well, I'll start with the diving in question, because I think I have an advantage there in that my degree is in history. And then I got a law degree, and there's a lot of legal research, a lot of research in law as well. So research and research techniques are really old friends for me. Personal approach to immersing myself in any period is to research and read both primary and secondary sources until I start hearing voices. And I mean that literally. I need to start hearing my point of view character or characters. And it doesn't have to be both of them at once. But the moment that I hear that, usually at the most inconvenient place, I have a manuscript where the point of view character first spoke to me while I was driving home from dropping my son at school. And I had to pull over and write down what he said to me on a Starbucks napkin with a pen in my purse. But once that moment comes, I flip the switch from researching to writing. And that doesn't mean I stop researching entirely, because spot research is always necessary, even at the editing stage. And especially if you're writing for an audience as savvy as a lot of the people who read historical fiction, you have to be vigilant for anachronisms. But I do think you can get overly obsessed. And I think we write fiction, whether we write it set in the past or we write it set in the present. And so story has to always be driving the boat. Story has to always be the thing that is the focus. So I guess to get to the second part, I'm a historian by training, but I don't write about the past primarily to teach history. Mm-hmm. Some people do, and there's nothing wrong with that. I don't. Quite the contrary. I like to think that I write about timeless issues, and then I set them in what I call the safe distance of the past. I personally think the most important emotional, moral struggles that people deal with in their very 21st century lives are not new, and they're not at their core different than the issues were that people struggled with 500 or 800 years ago. And I think the most emotionally freighted issues are often the hardest to approach in real time. I think we all see that in our lives. It's very hard to look at something painful when it's happening. And someone, and I wish I had the citation handy for this, but I don't, but someone said the past is another country. And I agree with that. And I think that setting complex, big issue situations in the past can really allow people to approach them in a way that they can't in their lives, and that they might not be able to in contemporary fiction, although I'm sure contemporary fiction authors would argue with me on that. And I'll give you an example. We all know here in 2017, there continues to be victim blaming when women are sexually harassed or assaulted. And that quite often, young women in particular blame themselves to a point where they don't even report incidents, which is heartbreaking to me. Now, in my second novel, Medici Daughter, my main character falls into that trap. And across more than 400 years, the injustice of her experience is, to me, really a heartbreaking slap in the face. And I expected it when I wrote it to generate recognition in people and also deep thought. And maybe give them a chance to recognize patterns in their own lives and in our society that would resonate with them, and that because it caught them a little by surprise, being in a different setting, would let them think about it in a way that sometimes we turn off the news when it addresses these issues. Or another issue that I thought was very interesting, and it comes from my first book, is what do we value in a man? I'm of a certain age, so back in college, I took a number of women's studies courses, and at some juncture, we had this little task where we dissected a stack of advertisements, and I was just horrified by how women were objectified and how the message was sent really not very subtly that a woman's value was dependent on her physical attractiveness. And during that class, I can remember the professor, although I can't remember her name, pointing out that society has an equally unfair rubric for judging men. And what she said was, men judge themselves and each other by the size of their paychecks and their insert other P word that we don't say on podcasts here. And, you know, decades later, when I started writing my first published novel, it was about two sisters, 13th century sisters, who became the queens of France and England. And so it, of necessity, involved their husbands. Louis the Ninth of France, who went on to become a saint in the Catholic Church, St. Louis, and Henry III of England. And what I discovered was that history had come to incredibly clear conclusions about these men. Louis was successful and Henry was a failure. Mm-hmm. And in the process of writing the book, that really frustrated me. And I started to realize it's because of how big H history judges men. And traditional history, political military history, celebrates men who are effective rulers, and they just don't care about the personal aspects of those men's lives. But if you take that forward now into our century, it raises a pair of questions that, given the fact that unlike the brides I was dealing with who didn't choose their own husbands, we choose our own husbands, raises these questions. Should the definition of a successful man not include their competence as a husband, a father, and a friend? And secondarily, is it better to be married to a traditionally successful man who has little time for his family, or to a good, loving partner who is basically an epic professional failure? And I don't care that my book is set 700 years ago. I think those are 21st century questions.
I think you also have the caveat that in the modern world, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I know that we have certain understandings of the past that have been taught to us that may not necessarily be 100% true. But in the modern world, the woman can be the success, and she doesn't have to depend on the man to be the success. So you weigh that in there too.
This is always fascinating to me. I would rather be a noble woman in the 13th century than a British woman in the 19th.
Really?
Yes, because the women of the time I deal with in my first book, they have titles in their own right. One of mm-hmm. the sisters of the two who are my main character actually inherits their father's title as she becomes Countess of Provence in her own right. And even though she's married to the brother of a French king, he cannot inherit that title when she dies. It must go to one of their children. One of the women's uncles becomes a count somewhere. And when his wife dies, he has to leave the country. He has to leave the county because her son, by a prior marriage, takes over. Women's progress is not linear, and we like to think that it is. A perfect example would be in Roman times, women could get divorces as easily as men. That was not true later. All they had to do in those days was say, I consider myself divorced. And in most cases, if they were wealthy and they had a powerful family, they would get what they brought to the marriage back. I think there is that also. But you're right. In this century, we don't necessarily need our husbands to or our partners, be they male or female, to be the person
to be the providers.
Who kills yeah. everything we're going to eat.
You're absolutely right. We do think about women's liberation and women's justice issues as a steady increase, whereas there have been plenty of times in the past when women did not have it all that bad. And Rome is a good example of that if you were from a good family. But I think that's kind of true of most cultures. You had to be from a good family first as a starting point if you wanted any kind of power.
Noble women had shorter lifespans than, say, women of the merchant class in some periods, because they were expected to marry earlier, and they were viewed almost primarily as someone who had to breed. It's fascinating how much variety there is. It also is encouraging. We have moments all the time. We are having some in this century where it feels like we're being dragged backwards on some issues. Mm-hmm. And we have to know that that's happened before. Women will persevere, I am absolutely convinced, ultimately. And we just have to think sometimes we rush forward, and sometimes it's one step forward, two steps back.
You mentioned anachronisms, which I personally enjoy finding them. I hate reading them, but I enjoy finding them. For our listeners, an anachronism is when you have something that is completely out of context or inaccurate in terms of the culture, the world, the time period that you're writing in. So I'm curious for you, and you don't have to name the book, obviously, but what is an anachronism that you have spotted as a reader that just made you flinch?
Well, I have a favorite one that won't bother most people, but it was seeing tea being served in Britain in a royal court before tea as a practice existed. Uh-huh. Because there was no tea imported yet at that point. I mean, we think of tea as quintessentially British, but that depends very much on the time period. And I suppose that is not one that would bother a lot of people. What bothers me almost more is when people will get called out on something that readers are really, really sure they're right about, and they're not, and there's really nothing the author can do in that situation. That actually happens a lot more than you think, where people have some idea, some historical idea, either from pop culture or just because they were taught it in high school, and history, like everything else, changes depending on discoveries and on theories and on what the current analysis is. If you write in the past, you will one day get a 5-page single-spaced letter about something that is wrong in your book that you have researched up one side and down the other, and you could probably give an academic paper on, and it's not wrong, and you just have to walk away.
Yeah.
Bad for the brand.
You have a short story in a collection called A Day of Fire, A Novel of Pompeii. which is a story told in 6 parts by 6 different authors spanning the destruction of Pompeii. So what was it like working collaboratively with 5 other authors?
I should preface this by saying that Day of Fire holds the distinction of being the first true continuity ever published in the genre of historical fiction. And I know nice. I have to back up and explain what a continuity is because I didn't used to know either. A collection of stories by various authors that's in a book where each story stands totally on its own, and even if they're on a unified theme, each story is independent, is what we call an anthology. And those have been around forever. But a continuity takes it a step further. You have multiple stories, and in our case it was 6, and each has to have its own narrative arc, but all of them need to fit together to form a larger narrative, which basically comprises a full-length novel. If you're going to do that, which is what we did, that requires a level of coordination and cooperation that can be maddening, but also I learned so much from that experience. At the get-go, 4 of us were actually able to sit down in person. We went to someone's house, we sat around their dining table, had some great pictures from it, and we did this giant timeline. And that was literally the plotting day to end all plotting days, because we had decided that in order to drive the narrative of the destruction forward, and you want it to go forward like a freight train, no 2 authors could show the same event. So, for example, my story is 2nd in the book. And it climaxes with the earthquake that preceded the eruption. But I needed to stop moments before the mountain actually blows its top. I can't show that. It's not in my timeline. I sincerely believe my ability to tightly plot action and to understand what's essential to plot line and what is self-indulgent was so helped by that co-plotting experience. And it also, to tell the truth, helped me with my little word count problem. My debut novel, the one that was actually published, my debut novel, The Sister Queens, was 160,000 words.
I know that it would be long in my arena. Now, in historical, is that still considered bulky?
Well, I would say it was on the borderline, upper borderline then, and the novels are shrinking. So now I don't know if it could do it. But see, in A Day of Fire, I had 15 or 20,000 words. That's it. Yeah. There's no wiggle room. You can't go upward. And I think as a result, I don't think it's a coincidence that the most recent manuscript I handed over to my trusty agent is a slender 100,000 words. Now, you can tell I write in the past when I say slender, but that's certainly one of the legacies of A Day of Fire. But there's another one. And this, to me, really blew my mind. Once we got started, we had to do what we called real-time co-writing. And that was necessary because characters traveled from story to story, but they remain the property of the author for whom they are a central character. So for example, in my story, there's a prostitute named Capella. She appears fairly prominently in my story, but she's actually a primary point of view character from the story that closes the book, which was written by a very talented author named Stephanie Dre. So in the scenes where Capella interacts with one of my 2 point of view characters, a man named Sabinus, every piece of dialogue there had to be written in real time in Google Doc. That taught me so much about dialogue. And I like to think I was good at dialogue before, but when we compose dialogue on our own, yes, our characters surprise us. In fact, I can get quite angry at my characters because they definitely like to do that. But let's face it, we have an outline. We know where this thing is going. Quite frankly, we manipulate things. But when you type a line of dialogue into a Google document and another author responds in real time, you quite literally have no idea what their character is going to say. So that's terrifying, but it's also liberating. And I think it has led, for me personally, to very, very organic dialogue that has helped me to keep my point of view character both there and since then more honest and fresh. And I really have tried, I don't know if I succeeded, but I've really tried to carry that forward into my non-collaborative work.
It's the difference between having a monologue in your head with yourself and truly having a dialogue with someone else when writing dialogue.
Actually, the group that started that collaboration now is affectionately called the H Team. And they actually have put out 2 more volumes since I was involved in the first one. And we have some more planned. And I'm actually going to be part of another one coming up here. And I'm looking forward to it almost like you'd look forward to vacation.
This collection was also with an indie pub. your first two solo releases, Medici Daughter and The Sister Queens, were with Big Five publishers. Can you tell us about the differences between working with a Big Five and with an indie?
Yes. So basically, A Day of Fire made me a hybrid, which is a fancy term for a writer who works both traditionally and self-published. And to be honest, when we started, our collaborative was not adverse to traditionally publishing A Day of Fire. But what we found is, given the business model of mainstream publishing, a lot of publishers were worried about the continuity concept because, as I've mentioned, there'd never been one in historical fiction before. In fact, they pretty much existed only in romance at that point. And because we were basically viewing our collaborative work as a chance to experiment with form, with style, with content, as well, of course, as a way to cross-pollinate our audiences of readers, we fairly quickly realized, and we continue to feel, that publishing that work ourselves gives us the control we need to push boundaries. Mm-hmm. And also gives us the ability to set deadlines. And when you've got six authors or seven authors involved, that is so critical. I will say I was somewhat insulated from the differences of it because we are extremely fortunate. One of our founding members was already and is still a self-publishing genius. And she already had a limited liability corporation set up to handle that. Mm-hmm. So she knew the ropes of formatting. She knew who we could contact to get a cover designed. She knew the ins and outs of distribution. And basically, she was willing to shoulder the business end of things. And to this day, whenever I see her for lunch, I basically genuflect and thank her because I don't know if on my own I would have had the guts to go that route.
Yeah, it's scary. I was part of an anthology collaboration with 12 other authors. Myself and two other YA authors, Kate Carius Quinn and Demetria Lunetta, we worked together to bring in 13 YA authors, and we all had short stories that it's hard to find a market for in YA. We put together a self-pub anthology of dark horror paranormal stories. That element of you're in control of everything is exciting and terrifying because you are doing your cover design, you are doing interior design, you are in charge of distribution, you are copy editing and making sure that there aren't any misspellings, because that's going to be super embarrassing if there are, because it's your fault. It's not a copy editor's fault. It's your fault. And we had some success with it. It's called Among the Shadows. But for the most part, it was exploratory toe dip into the pool to see what it was like. And I enjoyed it a lot. But I definitely, if I ever want to take something out on my own, which I don't rule out, I need to explore more just about visibility. To me, that is the hardest thing with self-pub, because anyone can self-pub and anyone can put their stuff out there, and thousands of people do daily. So getting someone to look at what you published today, I think, is one of the harder elements, just plain visibility.
I would agree with that. And I think that's why we viewed it as a cross-pollination. Mm-hmm. What our theory was is that, say, Kate Quinn or Stephanie Dre, or we had a British author named Ben Kane, who's a very big seller in the UK, their readers may not have read Sophie Pierrot. My readers may not have read them. So our goal there, we weren't thinking this was going to be a breakout. We were thinking we would be introducing ourselves to new readers. And I think the one thing that it does give you that we haven't mentioned here is control of price. I'm sure you found, as I have with traditionally published work, the ebook costs, the prices they put on ebooks are very high compared to the indie world. And I think that being able to control the price on these kinds of collaborative works actually, I think, can get a lot of people to put you on their Kindle. Now, whether they read you or not ultimately is another question, but people who might not try you at a $12 price point are certainly going to try you perhaps at a $1.99 price point. I would like to think I'm worth $1.99, but perhaps not.
We were also thinking the same thing with these 12 authors, that we could cross-pollinate our readerships and bring in our folds into theirs. But I think, especially in YA, I'm not sure if anthologies are ever going to really catch on. I don't know that the readership is really there for shorts the way it is in the adult literary world.
One of the reasons we decided firmly against an anthology is if you paid 99 cents or $1.99 for something because Sophie Perrineau is in it and my story stands completely apart, then you're just going to read me and you're going to put it down.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That way they're not picking and choosing off the table of contents.
Right. We had a lot of reviews. We just got a new one, believe it or not, today. The book's been out 2 years. We got a new one today on Amazon. And that's the reason I know that is it said the thing I'd like to hear the most. It said, when I went into this, if I hadn't known there were six writers, I would have believed this was one book written with one voice. Now, it doesn't mean the voices between the stories don't change, but the cohesion was such that we repeatedly heard it reads like a novel. I was worried about that, but it reads like a novel. And I think that helped us.
Coming up, finding inspiration in the past, the difference between selling on proposal and selling a finished product, and where to find Sophie online.
Unlike many historical novelists who stick with a time period or region, you seem to wander a bit. Your first book, The Sister Queens, is set in both the French and English courts of the 13th century. Your second, Medici's Daughter, takes place in 16th century France. So you've gone all the way back to ancient Rome in A Day of Fire as well. So what draws you to a particular time or setting, and do you plan to keep wandering?
I am going to hop around like a bunny. I can't help it. And I completely understand historical writers who want to go deep in an era and they become experts on a court, on a cast of characters. And I would put some of them up against the best academic historians of those periods. But I'm generally drawn to a story by an aha moment, by an event that inspires me, or by a discovery of someone or something that I feel has either been maligned in history or neglected. And if that's how you discover your source material, that's pretty serendipitous. I'll give you an example, two interesting examples. The first one is my original book that got published. The reason I had that file waiting, so when my agent said to me, write me another one, I could pull it out, is I had been researching Notre Dame in Paris for another purpose, for the manuscript that didn't sell. And while I was doing that, I read a footnote about two sisters who had become queens of two of the most powerful kingdoms of their era. They were from a tremendously powerful family, a family that I would call a celebrity family if that term had existed then. And yet I'm somebody with a history degree, had never heard of them. That made me insane. This is a story of influence, adventure, and sisterhood, and I have to come back and tell it. So I made a note. I copied the footnote, I copied some pages, I put them in a folder, and I said to myself, you're going to come back and tell their story. Now, more recently, my second example would be, I love to listen to music in my car, and I was listening to Robert Aubrey Davis, who happens to be local, but he used to have a program on Sirius XM radio, and this Baroque song came on. It was so marvelous. It was a tarantella about death. Extraordinarily unusual for the time period it came from, and I had to pull my car over. I can remember this, my son and I listening by the side of the road, and I started wondering, because it is not attributed to anyone, it's anonymous. I started wondering, who wrote this song? Why did they write this song? And I began this quest to either find a person who would reasonably explain this song or to invent him to fill in that gap. And that quest took me to the 17th century papal court of the Barberini. And it basically led to the manuscript that I just handed over to my agent. If you told me, oh, you're gonna write something 17th century, I would have said, no, I'm not. But I did.
It is interesting where inspiration can come from. And music often plays a role for many people that I know. But having that moment when you discover someone in history that you had not heard of, or an event that you had not heard of, that is so visually or emotionally impactful, I find that so moving. Someone that I'm completely obsessed with in history, and I had great intentions of becoming a historical author before I began writing YA, and maybe one day I will write this book, but Nero's mother, Agrippina.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Oh, she is fascinating. And it's just like, I am way into that woman. And she's completely maligned by everyone. All of the historians and the writers of the time absolutely hated her, but they were men. Right. She was a woman in power, and she was basically running Rome for a long time. And it was just really interesting to me. And one of the things I found that I loved, and I'll never forget, although I can't remember the historian that wrote it, was a famous historian, and he didn't like her at all. And one of the reasons he stated was that she walked like a man.
I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Margaret George. All right. Margaret George has a two-part Nero series coming out this year.
Interesting.
The first one, Confessions of a Young Nero, just came out. My copy is on the way, so I haven't read it yet, but it will be interesting to see how she handles Agrippina. What you say about the emotionally impactful moment, this really led me to a thought, which is, and I'm sure you feel this way too, I feel really privileged as a writer. I feel like I've been given extra lives, if that makes sense. I mean, mm-hmm. I get to live in the skins of different people. I get to travel to different places, and I get to bring those experiences alive for readers. So I don't want to limit those travels geographically or temporally. In my real life, the Sophie Perrineau who does laundry and who drives to pick up the mm-hmm. kids at school, I am absolutely limited geographically and temporally. There's no reason that my author alter ego has to be. And so I'm not going to let that happen to me.
No, I'm with you. I deal with that a little bit, not so much with time or geography shifts, but with genre shifts, because I write all over the place with genre, and I'm very fortunate in that my publisher allows me to do that and have encouraged me. If they like the book, they'll find a way to sell it. I know that I'm very fortunate in that. I agree with you, because if I have a story in me that's a fantasy and I've written a historical and a contemporary and a post-apocalyptic, but I want to go be in that fantasy now. Like, that's my headspace right now. That's the book that wants to be written. I'm not going to say, well, you know what, inspiration, you know, adventurous creativity side of my brain, you have to just relax because they don't know how to market it. You know what I mean? It's like, no, this book wants to be written. That's what I'm going to write. I never argue with inspiration ever.
I think that's completely correct. The only caveat for me would be I find when I have to pick what I'm going to do next, and I have multiple ideas, I will consult with my agent. The nice thing about my agent is he ultimately will not veto something. He'll mm-hmm. just give me his advice, and I've talked him around on some things where I've said, I've got to do this, and then he'll say, oh my God, you're right. Thank God I let you do that. But he's mm-hmm. talked me around on some others. I had an idea I was all set to go on, and I'd written the first section of it, and he said, listen to me, I love you and I love this, but this is so depressing. This is so depressing that I just have to tell you, I don't think that too many people want to read something this depressing. And so then I reached out to a couple critique partners. And then finally over dinner one night, I said to my husband, and he said, well, I really didn't know how to tell you this, but I wasn't going to read it. So I thought, oh, that's a bad sign. So maybe Jacques is right. Maybe that's not the project for this moment. So I put that one aside.
I do the same. I always ask my agent, what do you think is going to be more attractive to the publishing house right now? And sometimes, like, you're right, it is good to let things cook and to process the criticism.
I only work one book at a time. Both contracts for my books with major publishers were one book contracts. The most I'm ever willing to cede is that they get first look at the next mm-hmm. book. That has to do with control of my life. I also am very stubborn. So when I wrote my second book, and I wrote the outline and I wrote some chapters and I put a proposal in, and my first editor said she really liked it, but she wanted a different point of view. And I think a lot of people would have said, okay, because we can sign that contract right now before my first book even comes out. And I said, no. So I write complete books before I sell them. Not some of the time. Mm-hmm. All of the time. I invest a huge chunk of my time and my life in something that potentially, let's face it, I trunked my first manuscript, and I'm not going to ever say to anyone that's the last manuscript that might have to be trunked. Right. And I understand that that makes me an anomaly and that most people don't want to operate that way, but I think it's because I came from a large corporate law firm setting. You are operating almost in an indentured servitude. You're very well paid, but you're operating almost in an indentured servitude setting. My personal record, I believe, is I once worked 27 12-hour days straight without a day off.
Holy cow.
I made up my mind when I decided to do this that I was going to do it for better or for worse, completely under my own control. And I have to live with the consequences of that, but it's just interesting when I hear people selling things on proposal. If I ever were to do that, I probably would freeze up and be unable to write it.
All except for my first book have been sold on proposal or partial, like 10,000 words. So I've signed the contract, and now I have to finish the book. So the first time I did that, it was very scary. But now, I mean, I adjusted and I'm used to it. I think it would be really nice to finish a book and sell a finished book again so that I don't have to have that, oh God, I gotta get this done, because that's not a good feeling at all. But I actually work best under pressure. So in a way, maybe that is the better way for me to work. I can go both ways. It kind of depends. It's been so long since I sold a finished book. Like, that was 2010. The main thing is just having the desire for the project. If I have that, I can deliver it whatever the manner is. If I have that desire, but I gotta have it.
Right. And I'm very good. I'm unbelievably self-disciplined.
Mm-hmm.
So much so, this is a true story. Like in college and in law school, if I had some reading, even the basics of life for me, I was raised business before pleasure. So I, for instance, say I have to read 400 more pages or I can't have a shower. That's how I work. That's who I am. I mean, I never work in yoga pants. I dress to work. And I set a lot of pressure on myself. So external pressure is not a good thing for me because I'm already so mm-hmm. wired that I probably would explode under those circumstances. So yes.
No, that makes sense. And that's a good illustration too of everyone having their own process, be it how they pressure themselves or how they actually bring about the manuscript in the first place.
Right, right. And I think that's the beauty of being in a creative field is, you know, there isn't one way to create something. And it also depends on what your situation is in terms of risk averseness, if you're trying to live on what you make or not.
Last question, what are you working on right now? Kind of answered it, but I will get you a little bit more in specific.
Well, interestingly enough, actually, I have two what's next. One is the completed manuscript that I referred to, and that's in the hands of my beloved agent, and one that I am actively working on. And the former, I'm really hoping to be able to make an announcement about later this year, and that mm-hmm. takes me further in the direction of what I like to call high concept fiction set in the past. And I'm very excited about it in that it features my first major point of view character who's entirely fictitious.
Nice.
Talk about liberating. And
I was going to say, that must have given you some freedom.
Oh my God. I plan to do that again. Let's just put it that way. And mm-hmm. the second project is also an exciting departure in some ways for me. It's going to seem like a bigger departure when I say it out loud in that it is a dual timeline. And one of those timelines is set right here, right now, 21st century. Well, actually not here because it's set in London.
Okay.
So another twist to that is there's sort of a thriller aspect to that book. And we have not one, but two investigations going on. One set in 21st century London and one set in 17th century London. I'm still in the deep dive of research, but the moment has come. I have just penned the scene in which I meet my 21st century point of view character for the first time.
And
I can feel myself slipping into her. And in fact, the other day, this is going to sound creepy to some people, but before sitting down to write, I actually made sure to put on her favorite perfume. Because we're at that moment now. And that's really great for me because when I finish the manuscript my agent has now, that book is such a book of my soul. No matter how it does or what it does, I can say right now, of all the things I've ever written thus far, it is the book that I will never be sorry I wrote. Nothing could make me sorry, but it was a little strange. My husband noticed, everybody noticed it. I went through actual grief when that book was finished and I knew, and I'd edited it, and I knew from now on I'd never hear those voices again except to edit. Mm. It was as if somebody had died. Almost the most profound grief other than a real death of a family member I've ever experienced. Back to the one that I'm writing now, not all my characters have a favorite perfume, but this one, she is a detective inspector with the City Police of London who has a specialty in criminal fires. She wears Iris Cinder, which is a perfume that has these overtones of ashes in it. So it just seemed perfect for her.
That's really cool. That's exciting. Do you have a working title for that one?
No, I am the worst And I admit it, I'm the worst person in the world at titles. I understand that titles are part of the marketing package. Mm-hmm. I have said in every case, although I like to have some veto power, I have always said to my publishers, I don't care what you call it as long as you sell it. Especially because as a baby author, you have so little power. But I send almost everything to my agent with titles that he ends up nixing. Yeah. The manuscript he has now, my initial title was Italian. One word title, but he said, you can't have this word. No one can say it. No one can spell it. Nobody knows what it means. I'm like, okay, fine. Call it whatever you want.
Oh, that's a good approach. I like it. Yeah. Okay, so lastly, do you want to tell us anywhere people can find you online, your social media, your Twitter, anything like that, your site? I know you have a beautiful website.
Well, thank you. I actually love the designer who did it, but I am completely addicted to social media. So my view of this is if listeners are looking for me, they won't have trouble finding me. Trying to avoid me might be a more difficult thing. So as you said, I have a website, which is very easy because it's just www.sophieperrineau.com. So if you can spell my name, you can find it. I have an author page on Facebook. I also am one of those people who has individual pages for each of my two novels. So if you're a fan of one of my novels and you just want to get on a page where we talk about, like today, for instance, is the 402nd anniversary of the death of Marguerite de Valois, who is the point of view character for my second book, Medici Daughter. So today I'm talking about that. I do On This Day in History on my pages separate to the books. If people have questions or if I see things related to that time period, I'll post them there. And then, of course, I am on Tumblr as MediciDaughter.tumblr.com. And I'm on Twitter as LitGal with an underscore between Lit and Gal. It's a tribute to my moniker on Agent Query, where we met originally. When I went to go on Twitter, the name LitGal without that underscore was already taken. I had to invent a little there.
Wonderful. Okay, well, I will be sure to link to all of those in the notes for the podcast.
And I just want to thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. I really was looking forward to it. And there are many truths that are universal in the industry, but I know that there's a lot of niche. Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire is produced by Mindy McGinnis, music by Jack Corbel. A special thank you to fellow author Alyssa Palombo and patrons Stephen Avery and R.C. Lewis for helping to make this episode possible. If you find the blog or podcast helpful, please consider showing your support by visiting patron.podbean.com/writer-writer-pants-on-fire and making a donation. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Writer, Writer, Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist.